does. I want to thank Tom and Karen Sism for living in a place with two numbers in their addresses. How can you have two numbers on a street? They do. They have two numbers on a street. They have four numbers south, and then they have a couple more numbers and west. How can you be south and west in two numbers? My iPhone didn't understand it. My GPS didn't understand it. And I think to this day, Tom don't understand it. But I got there, and I want to thank them for opening up their hearts and their homes to me last night. I had a good sleep, and tonight I'll be over in to meet a longtime friend I haven't seen in years. It's Tim Piles and his family over in Broken Arrow. But I'm going to take you to Africa today. I'm going to look at this thing and see if I can get everything moving, if I can hit that, and nothing happens. Okay, so what if I hit this? And nothing happens. Somebody help me. I'm a technological genius, usually. That's on. Okay, green for go, huh? Okay, there we go. I'm going to move around a little bit. I'm going to use a little levity, because if I don't use a little levity, I'll get real serious, and I'll be emotional, because this thing is so moving to me, with the people and everybody involved. I want to dedicate this presentation this morning to two friends that changed my life, and that being Sister Kreutz and her husband, Everett. I was in their house years ago, and they converted a man that's my closest friend in Africa. He's been my friend for 30 years, and they changed my life, and they didn't even know me at the time. And they only met me once or twice. And they came to Africa. Edra came over to Africa a couple times. She was so young, I had to put in a handrail to get her down the steps. A great lady, a good lady, and a normal lady, a Christian lady. And it just, she typifies this congregation and you people. No paragon of virtue, but just a good Christian woman. And she conveyed that to the Africans, that I'll get emotional if I don't stop. So anyway, Paul came into Jerusalem, and he, you know, Paul was not a good-looking guy. Paul was pretty ugly. I mean, he had a broken nose. Part of his ear was missing. I'm sure some of his teeth were missing. He had been beaten five times with stripes, 39 times, and his back, and it was all lacerated and all the scar tissues. So I'm sure he was hunched over like this. He's stoned until he thought he was dead, so I knew he had probably a piece of ear missing, nose broken, teeth out. Probably split lip, talk with a lisp. So I feel right at home today talking to you like Paul did. Because he wasn't a beautiful guy. But he had a message that transformed the world, literally. And it transforms lives. And that message is so precious and so easy to convey that it just defies the imagination. I'm sure when he went to Jerusalem, those disciples said, and the apostles said, "What? You did what? You raised who? Who? They were dead? They stoned you until you what?" And they didn't believe it. And I hope you believe what I tell you. You may believe most of it. I'm just trying to get across to you what God and His wisdom and His power is doing in Africa. Of course, we're going to go to Jos in northern Nigeria. Then we're going to go over to Chad, where 15 years ago there was no Churches of Christ in the whole country of Chad. None. A Muslim government where we started was a house of slaves. The Arabs would come down and take slaves, take them north. That's what they do today. Still the same thing. I'll take you there. Then we're going up to Niger. 8 years ago, there were no Churches of Christ in the whole country of Niger. It's a French-speaking country. Now we have churches in the country of Niger, and we're rolling along. This year, Lord willing, I want to take French and confuse everybody. Uganda, we started 18 years ago in Uganda, building a preacher school. We now have the preacher school. All the teachers have undergraduate degrees in Bible from the school at Jos. We brought them all over to Jos, taught them the Bible, four-year degree in Bible. Now they're back home. We've got a campus, and we're moving in Uganda. So in Chad, I went over there this March, took a preacher from Petersville, Alabama, down in Florence, Alabama, where we went into the southern rainforest of Chad, where we have graduates there, and met the kids. We went to a school. What we did, we rent to inaugurate a church building. We sent them some money. They made cement blocks. They brought in mud blocks. They brought in the governor of the state in Chad, and he cut the ribbons, and now we have a church building in southern Chad. Beautiful, isn't it? Their seats are not padded like ours, but it's a good building. It's the first Church of Christ building in southern Chad. We have 35 preachers now in that country. We brought the church together with a big celebration for the building. We brought in preachers and for a week-long seminars and classes in southern Chad. No running water, no electricity, none of that stuff. You sleep in a mud hut, a building with a metal roof on it, and you lay there and listen to water pour out of your body. It comes right out the pores. Some of our graduates went home after they graduated from our school in Joss. We have 2-year courses, 3-year courses, 4-year courses, and then we have a 4-year degree course where you have an affiliation with the University of Joss, which is a federal institution where you have to take 2 years of Greek and 2 years of Hebrew and write a thesis to get our undergraduate degree, a 4-year degree from our school. Some of our graduates went home with our 2-year courses and they found kids. So they started teaching classrooms. They built some mud huts with straw and corn stalks and ferns. And they started classes in French. We have over 600 kids in classes now. We have 6 classes, 600 kids, and we started looking. We feed them 1 meal a day out of 1 bowl, and they wash their hands and they eat with their fingers. They eat a couscous type thing. It's a pretty good meal. You wouldn't eat it, I'm sure. It wouldn't stay with you very long if you did. But these kids are 600 of them, and we found in the 600 there were 67 of them that were orphans that were hiding out in our classrooms, so they could learn how to read and write and get 1 meal a day. So we built a building so they could sleep at night in the building because they don't have parents. They don't have family. They don't have extended family. They are, in fact, orphans. We built a clinic over there. And the kids are fun. Kids are fun. Universal. They have a name for us, Owolo. And what that means is it's a human being with his skin peeled off. You know, normal human beings have black skin. So they think we're spirits. We're not normal. And so we must be spirits. And if we're spirits, to touch us is luck. Good luck. So they're all over you, everywhere. I mean, they're kids everywhere. They're kids. They don't have any inhibitions and, you know, the rest of it and prejudices and everything. They're just kids. And it's wonderful. We have a great time over there. Spent 2 weeks in southern Chad. This is their classrooms. We're building classrooms. We're building a building for 2 classrooms for each building, 100 kids in each classroom. So it's coming along. We got one building well underway, and we'll find ways to build other buildings. They make their own mud blocks. You can see their desks on their lap, and their seats are comfortable. And they're kids. They're just kids. I mean, it's just wonderful. That's all they are. And you don't have to put them in dresses. You don't have to put them in, you know, shoes and things like that. They're just kids. This is where we're building our first classroom building. And in 10 years, all these kids will be adults. Think about that. We have 600 members of the church in 10 years. 10 years, you think's a long time, right? Because you guys are young. Wait a minute. You will look back 10 years from now and say, what happened? Well, I'm here. It goes fast. We have 35 preachers here now where we had none when we started. And they're all preaching, 3 or 4 different congregations. And we get them together. We got a clinic there now in southern Chad. And we're putting a long-term clinic up alongside. And we're growing. In Joss, the School of Biblical Studies, Joss, is in existence. We celebrated our 25th anniversary this last year. This is Islam in northern Africa. Africa's a continent. It's not a country. You got 51 or 2 countries in Africa. To fly across the United States by jet takes 2.5 hours. To fly from Cape Town, South Africa to Cairo takes 10 hours. That's what we're talking about size-wise. South Africa has 38 million. Kenya has 28 million. Nigeria has 170 million people. In 20 years, they'll become the most third most populated nation in the world, behind China and India. Their average lifespan is 48 for a man, 52 for a woman. If you're old in Africa, then you're respected. If you have a beard, you are wise. If you have white hair, you're a teacher. They love me. Last time I went, I said, "Brother, I'm getting too old for this job." They said, "Brother Worley, you're not old. You're not old." I said, "Brother, I'm old. I can't trek like I used to trek up in those mountains." They said, "Oh, no, Brother Worley, you're not old." They said, "Brother Worley, are you over 70? I said, "Yes." They said, "Brother Worley, you're old." They didn't believe it. People, you don't see 70-year-old people over there. If you do, they're just laying in the village somewhere. They're not running around clogging and buck dancing, I guess. I don't know. It's a huge nation, though, and it's the largest black populated nation in the world. So I'll go weeks without seeing a white person. When I was in the Navy, I couldn't grow a beard. And so Didi and my children and I went over there, and for the first year after a year, Didi wanted to go home with the kids for the summer. And when they left, she said, "Will you grow a beard while I'm gone? I'd like to see you in a beard." I said, "Okay." So I'd worked with these guys for a year, and I went out into the bush, and I preached, and I taught for a month, and I came back, and I had a beard. And I'm driving around in the van. It says World Bible School, and a group of church members come up to me, about 8 or 10 of them, and they said, "Excuse me." And I stopped the van, and I said, "Yes." They said, "Have you seen Brother Worley?" And I'm looking at these guys. I worked with them for a year. I've only been gone a month. And I thought, well, my voice will trip it up. They'll recognize my voice. I said, "Yes, I've seen Brother Worley." They said, "Where is he? We're looking all over for him." I started laughing. I said, "Hey, it's me, guys. It's me. I'm Brother Worley." They said, "Brother Worley, we didn't recognize you. All you white people look alike." It's true. Whenever in a black nation they see white people, all they see is color. They don't see my beauty. I couldn't believe it. They didn't know my nose, you know, and my forehead, my long forehead. And it's true, whenever you see a person, a lot of times, all Oriental people don't look alike. Let me tell you, I can tell the difference between a Korean, a Japanese, a Chinese, a Filipino. None of those Orientals look alike. If you spend time in Vietnam or any other country in Asia, you'll know the difference between Asians, right? When you look at them, just by looking at them. You people, most of you, don't know the difference between a Korean and a Chinese, because you don't look at the person. You have to look at the person to see the person. You have to look beyond the color. All white people don't look alike. All black people don't look alike. In fact, I'll be in a village at 3 o'clock in the morning doing riddles and talking in the hut. We do that for entertainment, and they'll say, "Brother Udo." And I'll say, "Brother who?" They say, "Brother Udo. You know him, Brother Worley. He's that black man." Yeah, right. Go on, let's go. And you look past it to see the person. They're all people. They all have souls. They all have a need for God. 10 years ago, the Boko Haram came into northern Nigeria. The troops came in and everything broke loose. We started suffering. They demolish our buildings. They kill our people. They murder them. They chop off their heads. They chop off their hands. They chop off everything and put them in ditches and mass bury them. There's been over 10,000 people killed in that red area of northern Nigeria right now. I'll go in the daytime, but I'm out of there by nightfall. I'll go in unannounced, and I'll go in fast, and I'll meet with the preachers or the teachers, and then I'm coming out and going back to Jos, where it's secure. We've got 2 buses at the school now, and they go out on campaigns in May before the graduation of last year. We sent this group of students down to Abuja, which is one day's journey. They went down there, stayed a week, baptized 15 people. This next group took another bus, went down to, spent 2 days on this bus, went down to the city of Lagos to a predominantly Muslim section, spent a week with the churches down there working and baptizing people, and they baptized 18. I think we baptized 64 people on those campaigns for that 1 week before our graduation. The School of Biblical Studies is second to none. It's got the best staff of any school outside the United States, and that's true. Where our student body is the largest it's ever been. We've been in existence 25 years. It's an all-African staff. We have a fully 4-year accredited program to where our graduates, if we're Nigerians, have to spend a year in public service through the federal government because they hold a degree from the University of Jos. All of our buildings are handmade. with the exception of maybe a bulldozer to plow the ground. This is our newest classroom that's built. Took 300 women to pour that second floor. A Nigerian woman or an African woman can carry 60% of her body weight on her head. 100-pound woman, 60 pounds on her head. So they carry our cement. They carry a baby on their back, 60 pounds on their head. I'm here to tell you this morning, my wife of 50 years has spent years in Africa, will carry nothing on her head. But they work. The women work. They do most of a lot of the labor equally with men. This is how it happened. This is how it started. Solomon and I started a school in 1985. This is how many students we have. This is today. We have over 115 students. They're from different countries. They speak different languages. The official language is English in Nigeria. So you can come with me. You can send Tom. You can send other members of your congregation over, like Edra came, and see the work and see what we're doing over there and see what you're a part of. These students are co-ed now. We have over 20 women students. About 10 years ago, my wife started going with me because I built a house over there for her as a guest house, and she started teaching the women how to do Bible classes and how to do children's classes and how to do VBSs, and she would go out on the weekends with other women and do ladies' classes, and all these ladies wanted to have Bible education, so they started wanting to send their daughters and themselves to the school. So now we have over 20 women students. We're co-ed. We don't have the facilities, so they're in the villages around the school, the campus, until we get a dorm built for our male students and take our male students and move them to the new dorm and wall and concertina wire around the male dormitory and put the female students in there. So I told Solomon, you got a problem. All of these young ladies that have come into classes want to have husbands. Hello. So what are their parents going to do? They're going to send them to us because we've got over about 100 men up there that are going to have educations and can teach in any school in Africa because they'll have a degree from the University of Jos through us. These are the men that you're sending through school from Liberia. They left their families, and with the exception of one, he brought his wife unannounced the second year so she'd be with them. We're still talking about that. But they left their families. The other ones left their families, came from Liberia, three countries over or four countries over, and are getting degrees. And then we'll send them back home, and they'll be the most educated men, preachers, in their country because I have a four-year degree in Bible, 2 years of Greek, 2 years of Hebrew. And every teacher, every weekend, is in evangelism without exception. That's been going on for 25 years. Every student, every teacher, every weekend, they go on evangelism. They're not going to come out of our school of theologians. That was the cardinal rule that Solomon and I prayed about and decided and told the elders that we asked them to make that a rule for the school, and it's been a rule for 25 years. One of our students 2 years ago from the Cameroons, third-year student, was killed on that evangelism by Muslims. Weekend evangelism still occurs every weekend, and it will until the school ceases to exist. Good man. We were really worried because a couple of them talked to me, and then I sent word to you guys, and you sent them home for the summer. And I called, and then the Ebola broke out in Liberia, and thousands have been killed from the Ebola epidemic and virus. And I called Solomon in August, and I said, what are you going to do? He said, what do you mean? I said, the Liberian students are coming back, right? And he said, well, they're already back. I said, well, what are you doing? He says, well, I took them down to the doctor, had them tested, and now we locked them in a room. And we're feeding them. And that's what happened. That's what we did. And God protected us. But literally, if one of those guys would have caught that Ebola virus, it could have killed all of us. Killed the whole school. Wiped out 25 years of work. But God protected us again. And in May, during our lectureship, I take Americans with me. And I'm over there. And Americans come. And we hope you'll send two of your men. And if anybody else wants to come, they can come. This year, two of my grandkids, I just have to, as a grandfather and great-grandfather, talk about my grandkids for a minute. But this is the friends that came to Nigeria. This is my granddaughter, Lola. She's 5. This is my granddaughter, Keegan. She is 8. And they look, I tell the girls every day at breakfast, how much they look like their grandfather and how beautiful they are. So by the time they reach 18 or 19, they're going to think they look like their grandfather and they're going to be beautiful. This is a man and his wife that's working with me now, the Coxes. This is their children. They're twins, boy, girl. And this is another preacher and his wife, Greg Hamlin, spent 10 years teaching at Joss, him and his wife. And this is a man, Randy Baker, that works with me. This is my lovely wife of 50 years. I told her the other night, I said, honey, I've never regretted marrying you. You're from Arkansas. I gave you shoes and a fork and taught you how to eat. And I want you to know you've been a good woman. And she has been a good woman. She continues to be a good woman. The African women call her Mama D. They call her in the middle of the night just to hear her voice and give them their greetings. And she's taught them how to work. And they work. And I'm telling you, the women in the church are the backbone. They're the workers. Brethren, they let us be the leaders. I understand that. And I'm thankful for that. I praise God for that every day. But you fire the women up in this congregation, and you're going to be in trouble, boys, because you're going to have to wake up and keep up with them. And they're going to want classrooms. And when we started to work in Africa, we were concerned about men and buildings. And we started building churches and baptizing men. And then Didi went over there and fired up those women. And all the women now want to have children. And the children have to have classrooms. And then you have to have VBS. And then you have to have all of these other things. You know, we'd have a perfect church if we could just get rid of the people. You know, I'm just joking about that. But they're great. It's a wonderful situation where you have everybody. Everybody in the church has a personal responsibility to work for the master. Do something. And you can do what you want. Just tell the elders about it before you do it and get their permission. And I've never had them turn down anybody. But we spent a month in Joss during the lectureship at a guest house. This is a house I built my wife. There's not a stick of wood in it. It's all concrete and steel and metal roofing and everything else. And you stay here. We have gardens. We have a two-year ag program in Joss. Every student gets a garden. It's a piece of ground 6 feet wide and 50 feet long. He gets two drip hoses, and he gets educated in growing enough vegetables in that plot of land with four crops a year instead of one, and raising his own compost, building his own compost, so you don't even need fertilizer, and he can feed a family of seven and then have one crop to sell during the dry season when there's no potatoes. He can sell his potatoes and pay his children's school fees. But this is a house, and we have a good time in this house. We have meetings all the time. It's terrazzo floors. There's Solomon Agu and Greg and the rest of us having a meeting. We have fellowships in there. We have all kinds of things. It's fun because Christians, there's one thing I've learned after being a Christian for so long is we can have good fellowships and fun fellowships and have a good time in life. If we can't enjoy ourselves, who can? I send over seeds before I go, so they'll go ahead and put them in the garden program and they'll raise American corn, queen corn. Africans try to eat it all before I get there. That's why I got it fenced. It's not for the goats and the sheep. It's for the Africans because they eat maize. And when they see the queen corn and they start eating it, they'll eat it raw because it's like candy. It's so sweet compared to their corn. So I've got to watch. I gave them seeds one time and they raised cantaloupe. And I come in and I said, how'd you like my cantaloupe? They said, cantaloupe. And I said, yeah, those melons. I gave you the seeds. I said, and I described them to them. They said, oh, Brother Worley, we threw those away. We didn't know how to eat them. I said, oh, man, what are you guys doing? The kids had to learn things. They had to learn termites, what termites were, because they come out two or three nights a year. And there's millions of them in the air, millions and millions you can carry. Grab five or six at a time, and they look like dragonflies. They're about as big as your little finger, and they have four 2-inch wings that are transparent. You can see them. They just fly all over, and you can grab them. And what the Nigerians do is sweep them up, put them in a bucket of water, and pull the wings off and fry them on a pan. They make 100% oil, their own oil, and they're 100% protein, and they taste like popcorn. A lot of them just eat them raw. They'll just take them, eat them, and pull the wings off as they go. When you have a gospel meeting like here, and you don't have any windows at night, You're standing there, and you have to call the meeting to stop for a minute, get all the little kids out with their brooms, and they sweep the floors because it becomes about this thick on the floor. They're crawling on your head and your body. They won't bite you or anything. Nothing wrong with them. They're just termites, okay? And you have to sweep the floors so people can't slide and fall down the aisles. They're great eating. The hardest part is getting them across the lip because when you're biting them, they're looking at you. The kids didn't eat them, let me tell you. The girls didn't eat them. They learned to dress. First thing the nannies did over there, seeing white girls, they didn't know what to do with them, so they cornrowed their hair. That takes about 6 hours. I mean, it's really tough, but they loved the girls. The girls really had a good time. They had to carry the girls around like they do in Africa. The girls learned to, they tried to crawl on Dee Dee's back, my wife's back. My wife doesn't carry any children on her back neither, let me tell you. Nothing on her head, nothing on her back. That's the way it is. They had things in the yard that they had to get used to. I mean, big ones, 400-footers, or 4-footers, not 400-footers. You think they look like 4-footers. The preachers, and when they go to Africa, have to get used to preaching. And, you know, the Baptists, in most places in America, referred to us as the Church of Christ as the people with the clock in the building. Yeah, we're the people with the clock in the building. Every Church of Christ you ever go to, in the South especially, has a Church of Christ clock. And that's for the preacher, so you don't go overtime. I'm telling you, this is true. In Heath, Kentucky, I've been there, I've seen it. I heard it for so long, but this is true. In Heath, Kentucky, I walked up forward, I looked. Little country congregation had a Church of Christ clock. Under the Church of Christ, 4-inch letters, stenciled in black, shiny paint, said, "Remember Lot's wife." It's true. Well, in Africa, in the big churches in Africa now, they're becoming conscious in the cities of time. So they have 3 lights. There's a green light, a white light, and a red light. And you can preach as long as the green light's on. When that white light comes on, you've got 3 minutes. When the red light comes on, you better get out of there, because they'll come get you. Yeah, you got a guy that switches the lights. And they're really conscious about preaching. Now, you get out in the villages, they want you to preach for 3 or 4 hours. And then they want to question and answer period because they trek 20 miles or 15 miles. They don't want a half-hour sermon. And so you're preaching all the time, and you're soaking wet. I mean, it's hot, and you're in a mud hut. This is our staff. Every one of them have a master's degree or above. 9 of them have come to Freed Harbor University and got their degrees, master's degrees or above, at Freed Harbor University. Our first student came and got a 4-year degree in Bible, a 4-year degree in education in 20 months. None of these people have spent 4 years in America. Every one of them came over, got their degrees, and everyone we brought has gone home. None of them are here. Right now we have one of our Ugandans that got our 4-year degree. And he came from Uganda, got his 4-year degree in Jos, went back to Uganda, preached for and taught for a couple years at our school in Uganda, came to Freed Harbor University without any leveling courses, and entered into the master's degree level, 12 hours the first semester, last semester, and got all A's and B's. He'll stay here for 2 years. He'll get a master's degree in education, or in Bible, and he'll go back home to his wife and 4 children, whom he left in the mountains of Kasisi. That's how dedicated they are. Our staff in Jos, there's 8 different tribes represented in our staff. 8 different tribes are these people. They all speak 3 or 4 languages. They're tribal languages. And you say, well, what does that make any difference? Well, in Africa, in America, we have racism. In Africa, you have tribalism. These people are raised in villages and say, well, you know, all the Igbo people are thieves. All the houses are liars. You never trust. Son, when you grow up, don't you ever trust a Yoruba. Okay? And then they come to Jos. They spend 4 years sitting at the feet of our teachers. They see a Yoruba working with a Hausa working with a Nabibio, an Nabibio working with a Muslim, or a converted Muslim, from the Ahmadiyya sect. And they see all of these different tribes working together. And then you have a woman in the tribe that has her master's degree, and she's working with those people. And we're preaching unity, 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 and they see the unity for 4 years. That enables them to go anywhere in Africa and preach the gospel, no matter who the tribe is. Because they've seen us work together, they know they can work with any tribe. because they've learned it by sight and by sound. And it works. And all of our teachers, two of our teachers, one is a converted Muslim from the Ahmadiyya sect in Patichka. He came, he's got his master's degree from Freed, went home, got his PhD in Africa. Our vice president has a PhD. Three of our teachers, because we have degree programs, three of our teachers are in a PhD program at the University of Jos. In another 2 years, we'll have five staff members with PhDs in a Bible school now. And that's powerful. It really is, if you stop thinking about it. We turn out 20, 25 students a year, men and women. They go on for their medical degrees. They go in for law degrees. They go on for all kinds of education. Our graduates, if they're Nigerians under 30 years old, have to spend a year in the Nigerian Youth Corps. And what it is the federal government of Nigeria places them in schools around in Africa or around Nigeria, throughout Nigeria, and they have to teach free for a year as medical or as students placed by the government. We have annual lectureships that you need to send somebody to. We have our 25th anniversary this last year. We had our celebration. We have graduates. Now we've turned out well over 300 graduates in our 25 years. They're all over the world. We got two of our graduates teaching in Bangladesh. We've got a graduate in Australia. Three of our graduates in Zimbabwe. Two of them in a school in Zimbabwe. We've got them in Cameroons in the schools. We started a school in Chad that they're teaching in. They're all over, literally all over. Liberia and this is just some of them, South Sudan. And it keeps working. We've got a Bible correspondence course in Uganda now and Nigeria. We're going to look at you guys running a Bible correspondence course in Liberia, all the way across the other side of the continent. That'll be self-sustaining, and it'll be all in Liberia, hopefully. I've got about 18 Nigerians that I work with that are scattered out in Muslim villages. And their job, they're supported by American congregations, each one, and they report to their American congregations, and they're evangelists. They're missionaries in the foreign tribal areas. And some of them, we lose them to the Muslims. They come in and butcher them at night. They'll cast spells on them in the south. They'll get the witch doctors after them. They undergo a lot of persecution for Christ. Great men, good men, all of them married. They got children and working for the master. They're my co-workers. Of course, land is at a premium in Jos. We put 76 holes in those big rocks there, put dynamite in them, blasted them out. We blast them out, and then we buy old tires, dig under them, set the tires on fire with kerosene, and burn the rock like they did the castles back in the Crusades day. The rocks get cooked, and we take a 12-pound sledgehammer, and we make gravel, aggregate. We can make small gravel, big gravel, whatever you want. And we got a tractor to degrade the land, so we make our own rock, make our own block, make our own everything, really. We almost make our own students, I'm telling you. We grade the land. I taught them how to drive a tractor. You want an experience in life? It's not riding a motorcycle like Tom. Teach a Nigerian how to drive a tractor. That's fun. You set up on that back bar and teach them how to use the clutch. And they work. It works. You can teach them after a while if your back don't give out. And then they grow their gardens. And they grow food, let me tell you. We have composting. I teach composting, a two-year course. And we grow everything, all kinds of vegetables. We grow it in the dry season when no other Nigerian grows it. The country of Niger, we moved into the country of Niger with this Nigerian family. His wife's a nurse. They're working in Niger now. We've got three graduates from the schools. Our school's working in Niger now, and they've got a church building. This was a Muslim. He was converted to Christ in high school about six years ago. Yeah. And his family threw him out, wouldn't pay his school fees, so he needed money. So we asked a member of the church to buy him a donkey. And they bought him a donkey and a cart and some plastic jugs, and so he worked his way through high school, going to the river every morning, filling up with water, taking it to the village and selling it in the village. He did it all the way through high school. He speaks fluent French. It's a French-speaking country. He learned English. He applied to the School of Biblical Studies, Jos. He's in his third year. He'll go back with a four-year degree in Bible. Now this is where he's a boy. You ought to see him now. I mean, he's grown. He's filled out. And he'll be the most educated man in Bible in his whole country. And a church, we have a church building there, and it's growing. Uganda is growing. We started working in Uganda. We built a Ugandan Christian Bible College with all of our degree holders from Uganda. We sent this man. He left his wife and four children. He's in Freed Hartman University now getting his master's degree, living alone, trying to figure out what to eat. He goes to the cafeteria over in our universities, and he's just boggled because he's never seen so much food in his whole life. He came to me crying, asking me to explain why our students could take so much food and throw it away, because he'd never seen that much food in his whole life. We're building a dormitory for our male students. We blow up. Everything has to be blown up. I love dynamite. Man, I can blow up the world. I told the university or the people at the lectureship, at 3 o'clock we're going to be blowing up behind the library, so don't get excited. Well, that day at 3 o'clock we blew up for a foundation for our new dormitory. At 3:10, the Boko Haram blew up the marketplace in downtown Jos, killing hundreds of people. And it's strange in a lot of ways how we adapt. You know, I get up on Sunday morning, I got my wife and I got my granddaughters there, and I'm thinking, Lord, why do I need to go to church? We can worship right at the house. I mean, we've got 11 Americans there. We could just worship at the house and not go down. Off campus, there's a Church of Christ, a big one. And 300 members have been there since we started, before we started. And I don't really have to go to church because it's too dangerous. You know, we're all targets over there. But then I remember my brethren go to services. They go to worship God. They present their families to God on Sunday morning. And they look for me. Okay? So we get the kids dressed, we go to worship service, and women can't carry purses, and they search people, and anybody suspect, they take them aside and look at them. But when you're sitting there in a worship service to God, like in the Lord's Supper, and you hear bombs going off in town because there's no windows, the windows are all open because of the heat, and you're sitting there and you're thinking, I'm wondering if I'm going home for lunch or home for lunch. It's literally those decisions, those possibilities. And then you look over to Nigerians and they've got their babies with them. They got their children with them. And you ask God to forgive you for thinking about those things. But he forgives us. But it's just normal. That's what you think about when people are blown all to pieces. But nothing will prevail against the church. We'll be there for eternity. And that's the way it is. Okay? Let me close with this story. I am over time. We were supposed to be out of here at 10:30, 11:30. I'm over time. I'm sorry. I get to talking. I am sorry. I don't run over time. It's not a good reputation to have. Let me tell you one story. I brought an American here. Or the church in Hagerstown, Maryland decided to bring an African here years ago when I was living in Alabama. He was a preacher. A businessman, a turn preacher, and he went to the north and he was working for the Hagerstown Church of Christ in Kaduna, in the northern part of the country. And they said, we know you're home, Steve. We want to bring him over for a gospel meeting. He had 8 kids and a very good-looking guy, you know, I mean, a very statesman-like kind of guy. And he went to Hagerstown, Maryland, preached a gospel meeting and had a baptism. And then he had time, so they sent him out to Texas to see some World Bible School teachers that he had known through the mail for years. And then they called me and they said, will you take him back to Nigeria with you? You're going back, and it's going to be a week or two before you go back. Could we send him down to Alabama to you? Well, I've lived with Nigerians, you know, for years. I said, send him down. I'll take him. And I have a truck. I'm living in Gadsden, Alabama, which is the most perfect place in the whole world. They got a 40-foot waterfall right outside of town, on the mountainside right outside of town. And it's a beautiful place. Coosa River goes right down through town. I own a truck. I've always owned a truck. If you're in the South and you're a guy, you have a truck. Truck has 8-inch bumpers. That's so you can put all the gun stuff on there, you know, all the stickers on the bumpers, right? So I bring Marshall Ikaite down to Gadsden, Alabama. I'm driving around during the day, and I say, Marshall, you've been to the north of my country in Maryland, and you've been to the west of my country in Texas. I says, and now you're in Alabama. What do you think of my country? He said, you know, Stephen, When people in America die, they have no place to go. I thought, what in the world is all this about? I said, what are you talking about, Marshall? I said, what did you say? He says, when people in this country die, they have no place to go. I said, what are you saying? Are you making fun of my country? He looked at me, serious, a heart attack, and he said, Stephen, this is heaven. You have electricity around the clock. You have running water in every house. You have telephones in the houses. He says, there is literally nothing you people don't have. God help us, he's true. It is true. I have more shoes than I can wear. I have more telephones than I can answer. I have more televisions than I can watch. I mean, there's nothing I don't have, pretty well. And if I don't have it, I can go to Kmart and get it, or Walmart, or to my friends, and they'll give it to me or loan me one. Tom will loan me his motorcycle. If I ask him and plead it enough, I know he would. There is literally nothing, nothing we don't have. Tom, I'm not going to do that. If you stop and think about it, I don't tell you that to make you feel guilty. I tell you that to make you feel thankful. There is literally nothing we don't have, and God gave it to us. We have everything imaginable, or we can get it. And we are, in a century, in the history of mankind, the most blessed people in the whole civilization of mankind. Through history. Nobody had it as good as we do. And I tell you that to make you feel thankful and to know that God has put you here in this place at this time in history for his purpose. There is no one sitting here, old or young, that doesn't have a purpose designed by God to do. We all have a mission. There's no trash in the church. There's no junk in the church. Every person is a priest, is a child of God, set aside for a specific purpose in his church. And to equip, to do that, and to make sure you know that, he equips you. He gives you his son inside you. He says, if you believe in me, you believe in my son, you repent of your sins, you give your life to me, willing to confess with your mouth that you believe, submit your body to be buried in the likeness of his death in that watery grave, you'll be crucified with Christ, your body of sin will be destroyed, and by the very power of myself, the God of creation, I will raise you up out of that water, that grave, a new creature. And I'll give you a purpose in this lifespan that you have given to me in your service. And I'll equip you with the Holy Spirit. I'll give them to you and we'll come and make our abode within you. I'll add you to my church. And you'll have what Jesus brought you, life. And then you get on with it. That's what it takes. You'll be a better sailor. You'll better be a better policeman. You'll be a better machinist. You'll be a better civic worker. You'll be a better politician. There is nothing in this life that God and the society counts as decent that you can't do better as a Christian than you can as a non-Christian. I know. For 11 years in the United States Navy, I was a chief petty officer and I was a non-Christian. For the next 11 years, I was a chief petty officer as a Christian. I was a better man, a better person, a better chief petty officer, a better husband, a better father, because I was a Christian. People trusted me more. If you're subject to the gospel invitation, don't delay. Don't delay. Nothing's going to change. But if you do accept Christ, become a Christian, I guarantee you, along with Jesus and along with God and along with his word, everything will change for the better. Everything. If you're subject to the invitation, won't you come while we stand and sing?
In heavenly armor we'll enter the land. The battle belongs to the Lord. No weapons are fashioned against us will stand. The battle belongs to the Lord. And we see.